This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, and I'm Paul Rayburn, sitting in for Ira Flatow. Today, parts of the National Homeland Security Act go into effect, protecting vaccine makers, hospitals, and other healthcare workers from liability for any ill effects from smallpox vaccination. That change may seem small, but it makes it possible for the first stage of the National Smallpox Vaccination Program to begin. In this first phase, about 500,000 military personnel and about the same number of healthcare workers will receive the smallpox vaccine. For military personnel, the vaccination is mandatory. For healthcare workers, it's voluntary. If all goes well in this first stage, smallpox vaccinations will then be offered to more healthcare workers and to first responders, such as police officers, firefighters, and emergency medical technicians. Up to 10 million people could be included in that second wave. Vaccinations would be available to the general public by early 2004, about a year from now. But the government says it currently does not recommend vaccinations for the general public. So the question is, is this a good plan? What are the risks and benefits? And are we moving too quickly? If you'd like to join our conversation about the vaccination program, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And if you'd like more information about what we're talking about this hour, check out our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you will find links to this topic. Now I'd like to introduce my guests. The first is Michael Osterholm. He is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy and professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And the second is Christine Gebbe. She is vice chair of the Institute of Medicine's Committee on the Smallpox Vaccination Program and also director of the Center for Health Policy at the Columbia University School of Nursing here in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I'd like to start with Michael Osterholm. Can you tell us, give us the basic pieces of the vaccination plan, what's supposed to happen, how it unfolds?
Well, first of all, the plan is really about preparing our country in even its most fundamental way for a possible release of smallpox virus as part of a bioterrorist event. And the focus really is twofold. One is to go at those individuals who are most likely to be on the very first line or front line of such a response should it occur. And that really is part of the stage one or that first group of individuals you noted. The second part really is about safety. We want to do this as safely as we can with a vaccine that's less than ideal. And so what you're really talking about is rolling out that first group into the second group, which would help provide more of the infrastructure or the basic support for what might be a much larger response, if necessary, to vaccinate a much larger part of the population.
Now, why do you say the vaccination is less than ideal? I thought this was one of these things like aspirin that was tried and true and around for a lot of years, and so I'm surprised to hear that.
Well, actually, that's true, and you said it all very well, and we know today that, unfortunately, aspirin can cause some very serious adverse events in some individuals. Nothing that we take today from a medicinal standpoint or even immunizations are perfectly safe. However, in this case, smallpox vaccine, which we're using here, is actually a vaccine made or including a different type of virus called vaccinia, or of a virus that was used successfully to create the antibody or immune response in the host for decades prior to stopping using it in the in basically the 1970s.
That came, didn't that come from cows originally, the vaccinia?
Well, it's actually similar to a type of cowpox virus, the family of orthopox or pox viruses. And what it does is it, by inoculating you, in this case, on the arm and growing the virus there on what you can actually see, where that little scar is for those who have been vaccinated, that activity actually stimulates the body to produce immunity against smallpox itself. It is not smallpox that we're vaccinating with. That vaccine was incredible in the fact that it led to the eradication of smallpox worldwide in the 1970s and ultimately stopped vaccinating throughout the world by 1980. In this case, however, we are concerned that there are adverse events that occur with that vaccine. 1 to 2 per million population may die from the vaccine. 14 to 15 may have a very serious life-threatening event. Another 30 may have a serious health problem as a result of getting the vaccine. So we don't want to minimize the implications there, but again, what we're trying to do is screen out people who might have one of those reactions, now voluntarily asking people to come forward so that we would have a core group of people prepared should smallpox ever be released.
But we don't know who is going to have those reactions. Is there any way to tell who's more at risk of that?
Actually, we do have some ways of telling, and that's based on the historic data from the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s in mm-hmm. terms of use of the vaccine. And what we try to do is identify people who have certain underlying health conditions that might predispose to them having a less than ideal response to the vaccine.
Okay. Christine Gebbe, you were part of an Institute of Medicine committee that reviewed the program. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Who asked you to do that?
The CDC asked the Institute of Medicine, as a group is chartered by Congress to provide impartial scientific advice, to give them some oversight on the implementation of this program.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually going to be an ongoing relationship for a period of several years here.
You'll be following it as it rolls out.
As it rolls out. But we have had one major meeting with a public hearing and then deliberations and issued our first letter report.
So what have you concluded so far? What does it look like? Are there problems? Does it look good? What do you think?
We have certainly raised questions as we've gone along. A major point to be clear is that we were asked to work with and advise CDC on the implementation of the program, and not the policy decision made by the country about going forward on it. So, you know, looking at that focus. And the questions we raise, or the issues we call attention to, have to do with communication and timing, that is, of taking advantage of what we know and what we learn as it goes forward to do this in as safe and scientifically appropriate a way as possible while communicating what is going on clearly.
Well, what are some of the questions or some of the potential problems that you identified?
Well, one of the areas in communication is the need for a very clear, scientifically sound spokesperson or spokespersons who can answer the health questions the way Dr. Ostrom just did very, very clearly outline for your audience here. But as the vaccine is started in communities, in hospitals, for example, making sure people know that this is a voluntary program to be ready for a risk that as yet we do not identify and can't measure, that the informational materials about adverse effects are very clearly communicated, that information is available for the households of those who might make decisions here. And that all of those communication materials, if at all possible, be tested so we know that they work, that they're clear. You may have seen some of the recent data from polling that suggests that we still have a lot of underinformed people in this country about smallpox, about its risks, about the vaccine.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me, actually. It's, Michael Osterholm, you talked about the eradication of smallpox. So that was one of the big science stories of the 20th century, I think. So if smallpox was eradicated, what are we worrying about here?
Well, first of all, I think the idea of smallpox as a disease coming back is one that unfortunately most of the society has forgotten in terms of what the implications mean of that actually returning. Let me give you an example. I can recall with stark clarity that on December 31st of 1999, while many people were concerned about what might happen with Y2K and all the computers going down, etc.
There's a memory from the past.
That's right. I was following actively on the internet all of the obligatory stories coming out from every major news service that day of the top 100 stories of the 20th century. And ironically, not one of the major news services around the world, not just in the developed world, actually identified the eradication of smallpox as a story in the top 100 stories, and I think many of us would argue that it probably should have been number one,
right,
if not right up there with getting to the moon.
What does that mean? We've forgotten about it, I guess.
By 1999, we had forgotten. Smallpox killed upwards of 500 million people in the 20th century. It was totally eradicated from the world by 1978. It was out of the developed world by the 1940s and early 50s, and most of the world's population lived at the latter part of the century. To put some perspective to that, if you add up all the people who died in all the wars of the 20th century, including military and civilian casualties, all the people who died from HIV/AIDS from Africa in the 60s till the 1999, and you add up all the 1918 Spanish flu, influenza, swine flu problem, that's about 220 million people. So you understand what smallpox did, and we've forgotten about that.
Oh. Now that's your thanks for doing a good job.
Well, that's true. Now we live with the fact that we know that there are individuals, there are countries out there who have actually worked with smallpox, with the ways of bringing it back to be released. Now that we've had a waning immunity among our society, meaning that people who were vaccinated up through the 70s are no longer vaccinated, virtually a whole generation has been born since then that has had no immunization. Unfortunately, Christine, myself and others were a little bit over that age of having vaccination and now have waning immunity. So we have a very ripe population for this, and should smallpox be introduced back into the world, and the fact that it can be transmitted person to person after it has occurred in that first group of people, we pose a very, very high risk here of having it be a catastrophic event with even just a couple of cases.
I think it's worth clarifying or adding to what Michael just said, that smallpox as a disease in the world was eliminated. The virus wasn't eliminated.
The U.S. and Russia both have smallpox virus stocks they've preserved. Is that correct?
Officially. Those are the two countries.
Now, what do we know about unofficial things?
Well, I think it's fair to say right now that anytime you have intelligence information, it's always one that what makes it to the public and what doesn't is sometimes a large difference. There is, for example, a very well-defined KGB report that came out of the former Soviet Union at the end of the 1989-90 time period that details in great length the North Korean program. We have every reason to believe that Iraq has it for several different reasons. We don't have confidence that the extensive effort that the former Soviet Union put into place in the 1970s and through the mid-80s is under control, or that the extensive quantity of smallpox virus made in their biological weapons program is completely accounted for. When you add all that up, you have to remember it's not just that those groups or countries might use it, but remember on 9/11, not one of those hijackers knew how to build a Boeing 757, but they knew how to get one. Today, we actually have to be concerned not just about who might have the virus now, but who might be able to get it from someone else and use it. And so that there's a real possibility. We would hope never, but there's a real possibility that, in fact, this virus could return.
Christine Gebbie, is it hard to spread it if a group, a small band of terrorists, have a bottle of it or a culture plate or whatever they would have?
I am not an expert on the use of smallpox as a weapon. In terms of communicable diseases that we are familiar with, smallpox does not spread person to person as easily as many others. But certainly what I have understand is that it's possible to spread it deliberately with some degree of ease if that's what you have set about doing. The policy debate about whether one immunizes pre-event, that is before we know somebody's tried to spread it, or post-event, after we have the first evidence that it has been communicated to someone, revolves around whether the risks pre-event, the risks of the vaccine, are high enough you should hold off, because the elimination of smallpox cases from the world had to do with a very deliberate policy of responding post-exposure with the vaccine in a very deliberate process. Apparently, and certainly from the experiences we had eliminating the disease, if you move quickly post-exposure, you can very quickly limit the cases and bring it under control. The policy in this country has been determined now that pre-event we will have at least some people immunized. And again, that's what the IOM report focused on is, okay, given that policy decision, how can we encourage the CDC to take the deliberative steps?
Let me interrupt for a short break. We'll be right back. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday, and I'm Paul Rayburn. We're talking this hour about the government's new smallpox vaccination program. My guests are Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy and professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota, and Christine Gebbe, vice chair of the Institute of Medicine's Committee on the Smallpox Vaccination Program and director of the Center for Health Policy at the Columbia University School of Nursing here in New York. Christine Gebbe, go ahead and pick up where you were. Sorry, we had to break in.
Oh, no problem. I was probably going on too long. I guess one of my real concerns is that the smallpox program is a complicated one. The decisions and the thoughts about it are complicated. We know we've had enough difficulty communicating basic information about all of our vaccine programs to parents and families in the United States. And for that reason, the IOM committee focused a number of their recommendations to CDC on clarifying the communication, testing it in multiple languages and formats for different people. Don't rely too much on the internet. Get the facts out there for people.
Right. You mentioned Michael Osterholm, I think, talked about waning immunity for those of us. I'm one of those, too, who had it as a child. I've got the little mark on my shoulder still, or my arm. What happens if I encounter somebody with smallpox, or people like us? Will we get it, or what?
Well, first of all, some people will have protection even many years after the fact. If you were vaccinated multiple times, that increases the likelihood of having ongoing protection even 20, 30 years later. However, from our experience to date, particularly in some clinical trials that we're running right now at the NIH, in which we're vaccinating people who have been previously vaccinated, we often are finding people who have been vaccinated 30 or 40 years post their initial immunization are actually responding as if they'd never seen the particular vaccine before, suggesting to us that, in fact, they would not be protected if they had encountered the smallpox virus. On the other hand, there's likely some individuals who may not be fully protected but would be in a middle range of getting a much less severe disease if, in fact, they were exposed to smallpox. So, but the bottom line is I don't think we can count on any of those. We have to today have a group that can feel confident that if they're in a professional setting, in particular where they're on the front lines working with patients with smallpox, that they are protected. And I might add to that I think a point that Christine was making, one of the issues around smallpox that makes it such a critical agent is not just the people who would become ill. If today we had 5 cases of smallpox in this country, and that was it, I could guarantee you that this country would go into a panic. We would see tens of thousands of people presenting to emergency rooms with rash-like illnesses, thinking that they had been hit with smallpox, that for all they knew, a release occurred somewhere else. We would see our emergency rooms in ambulatory care facilities, doctors' offices, overrun. And we've already had that happen in hospitals as recently as last week in Washington, D.C., where a single patient came in with chickenpox, and the hospital was literally shut down for hours because someone suspected it might be smallpox.
Well, we got a taste of that a little bit with the anthrax letters, too, and the epidemic of fear is
we did
worse.
That too.
Yeah.
And so part of the issue is that we're not only just responding to a real disease, which is important. It's a very serious disease. And we don't know if they hit us once, could they hit us multiple times over multiple days, it's sure possible. But the point is this country also has to be prepared for the catastrophic fallout of even a couple of cases of smallpox. And again, that's where having a public health infrastructure, meaning the public health workers on the front lines, the healthcare workers on the front lines, prepared. So when those tens of thousands of worried well, and I say that meaning that they do have some rash illnesses, but it's not smallpox, come rushing in when all the national media shows that live on TV, again, further supporting the sense that there's a real national epidemic of smallpox, that too is part of our responsibility to prepare to deal with that. And that's
right.
Where, again, these healthcare workers will be critical on the front lines.
Right. Well, let me just give the listeners a chance to weigh in here for a minute. I think we have David from Kansas City. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, go
yes,
ahead,
I am.
David.
Thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely.
And I think you may have alluded to part of the answer of my question. My understanding is much of the discussion with the smallpox vaccination and been surrounding vaccination of first responders, people in emergency rooms, people in fire, EMS, police personnel. And I'm kind of two questions is what sort of do they foresee in terms of potentially spreading smallpox? And my the first manifestations I understand of smallpox are that of a rash, and how much thought has there been given that people would just be coming into their primary care physician's office with a rash that they may have picked up through some non-catastrophic event, if smallpox could be spread that way, would they just come into their primary care office or an urgent care clinic as opposed to, you know, an emergency room? And has there been a discussion on vaccinating, you know, primary care physicians and nurse practitioners in just those sorts of clinics across the country?
Christine Gebbe, do you want to tackle that? Primary care physicians, that's an education problem too, right?
Well, primary care clinicians of all kinds, that is wherever people go when they first feel bad, or whoever they call, need to know about this disease, about the vaccine program, about sorting out the symptoms, and sorting out the exposures. And yes, CDC has done some of that education, but the IOM committee firmly recommended that much more of it needed to go on, and that while focusing, for example, on dermatologists and infectious disease specialists who can make the final differential diagnoses is obviously important, getting word to the frontline workers is at least as important. Not so much a focus on immunizing them at the beginning. I understand that they are to be offered it in one of the later stages. But again, if they are practicing good practices in their clinic, people with rash-like illnesses being separated because of the risk that they have something like chickenpox that they could be spreading.
A lot of our primary care docs, I would assume, have never seen this at this point. Are they going to be able to make the diagnosis? Is it tough?
They will be able to, should be able to at least make the first sorting out. It is not unusually tough, and there are nice picture charts that can get you started, but you have to feel comfortable that you've been informed, and you have to know who to call at your state or local health department to get the backup you need. And getting that word out perhaps hasn't happened as quickly as it should.
Yeah, I think that part of the issue here is that, you know, having been for 27 years in the front lines of public health, I've seen far too often healthcare workers who we think of as being above the fear and the panic because of their training, their experience, actually having all the same human emotions that a non-healthcare professional does. And I've watched when a child with infectious meningitis, comes into an emergency room, and while possibly one or two people were potentially exposed to these children in a way that they might be at some risk of getting it, we had 150 healthcare workers who demanded antibiotics so that they wouldn't get this meningitis. No amount of reason helped us deal with that situation because there was this emotion.
Even for a relatively educated population.
Exactly. And so I think one of the issues we have to be prepared for, and I think this gets back to Christine's earlier point about communication, we just have to be prepared for that. And again, I come back to that's why I think it's important, because I have no doubt, just as within anthrax, I have no doubt that when the first cases of smallpox occur in this country, should they unfortunately ever occur, we will see tens of thousands of people with rash illnesses, because they're out there every day coming to emergency rooms with a psychology that, oh my God, I'm now infected with smallpox. And that panic and fear have in itself is a sense of an infectious condition. We have to do is we prepare at that point to be able to stand firm, to do our jobs, to sort through these cases. And I think the more healthcare workers that are adequately vaccinated, the more we are going to be able to do that in a very thoughtful and a controlled manner.
Thanks for calling, David.
Thank you very much.
We'll take one more call from, if I can push the right button here. Marcus, are you there?
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, Marcus, you're in Sunnyland, Arkansas, is that right?
That's correct.
Where is that?
It's near Mountain View. It's on the Ozark Plateau.
So you're in a rural area.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I think that's worth knowing, so go ahead with your question.
Okay, well, my wife is a recovery room nurse in a small rural hospital, and I'm sure that should this become reality, that she would be considered frontline being a recovery room nurse. And my question is, well, what about me being her spouse, or also children of these people? Is that not an increased risk for exposure to them?
Well, here, you know, let me underscore your location again, too, because we sit here in New York and Washington, and we assume that this is where something might happen, just as it did before. But what if something happens in one part of the country? Christine Gebbe, what about people, you know, on the Ozark Plateau? What do they do?
Well, the disease is the same wherever it would occur, and certainly with our modern society, someone who was exposed in one part of the country may be somewhere else before he or she becomes ill enough to identify the disease. And fortunately, this disease does not become transmissible before they're, at the point where there are no symptoms whatsoever, which gives you a little bit of time.
Say that again. Yeah, no, it doesn't. It does not become.
It's not one of those where it's heavily transmissible at that point where I don't even know I have it.
Okay,
yet.
So when it becomes transmissible about the time you figure
you're
out
already
you got
sick.
Something.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But the families of those who are being immunized are part of the risk equation. The potential of spread. If the immunized person, first of all, if the person thinking about being immunized is being thoughtful, he or she may decide not to take the vaccine because of a family member who has a compromised immune system, a small baby in the home. And there's a whole list of those that people are asked to think about before deciding to participate in this voluntary program. If the site of the vaccine is taken care of very carefully, from what we know, there is very, very little risk of spread. But following all the guidelines, taking care of that site, hand washing, all of those are very, very important, and no one should go forward into this voluntary program without understanding that and being prepared to follow it. And one of our recommendations is that there be a special handout available for the immunized person to take home to husband or wife or partner or other people in the household so they can read for themselves how to respond.
Does that answer your question, Marcus?
Well, it confirms the fact that everybody's facing right now is, you know, the whole thrust of terrorism is the what if, you know, and this is one of those subjects that there's no good what if.
Yeah, I guess that's right. And some of these decisions are going to be a little bit complicated for some people that they have to make if they have, you know, an infant in the house or something, as you say.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling, Marcus.
Thank you.
Now, Christine Gebbe, I'll lay this one on you because the nurses have been in the news lately. This week, the California Nurses Association urged hospitals not to participate in the program. I think some of their members were very concerned about the risks. What do we make of that?
We have questions raised by nurses, I think just because of their numbers and the fact that they tend to be organized in somewhat different ways than physicians or perhaps other workers, that are not unusual questions. And they have to do with the fact that if a person gets this vaccine, there is a fairly substantial chance of at least a day's missed work just because of the side effects of the vaccine, the minor side effects.
What is that?
I feel lousy. My arm swells up. And I don't want to go to work. There's a chance.
Nobody likes a shot, right?
You know, there's a chance of my workplace saying, I'm not sure I want you to work. So there's the issue of wages. There's the issue if I took this as a part of my job, I have to miss work or I have a serious side effect. Is that workers' compensation or not? And without clear answers to these economic questions, that are laid on top of the health trade-off questions that we've mostly been talking about, the organizations representing workers have said, slow down, go slow, talk that through first. I have to respect the questions they're raising.
Right. Let me pause for just a moment to say that I'm Paul Rayburn, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Michael Osterholm, the military folks that are getting this vaccine, it's mandatory for them. Are there some issues there, ethical issues or practical issues, or is that just something that they assume as military personnel?
Well, first of all, let me just go back and say that it's mandatory to the extent that, again, if you have an underlying health condition that would predispose you not to getting the vaccine, then you're not being required to get it. So there's no one being forced to get it who might have some identifiable risk factor there.
Right.
This is a decision that the military has made based on their assessment of risk of what is the potential for this to appear in the battlefield. From a readiness standpoint, they believe that it's necessary to do so, and that's why the president, as commander-in-chief, got his own immunization. I have to respect that based on the risk information. I think the question, though, that probably many of the listeners are asking right now and begging us to probably deal with is, why are we not talking about the general public getting this vaccine? And I think that that's an important distinction here, that on one hand, we're not trying to just take care of our own, the healthcare workers, but that is the first group that's going to see this virus. And one of the nice things that we do have with this vaccine, if there's such a thing to say about it, is that we know we can vaccinate people up to several days after they've been exposed and still provide very high levels of protection. So that one of the things that our public health agencies around the country, in conjunction with their local hospitals and doctor's offices, have worked up plans that said if smallpox were to hit today, could we vaccinate this country within 2 weeks, which would virtually guarantee most of the U.S. citizens protection in such a way that they wouldn't get smallpox even with release in this country, and at the same time keeps them from having to get the vaccine now and risk this potential risk of an adverse event. And so it kind of provides the best of both there. And I think that that's an important message. While the vaccine might be available to the general public, we are not recommending it, do not recommend it, and it would only be during a time in which smallpox was actually out there and we know it's confirmed.
So even if somebody's eager now and thinks that, from what they've heard, that they're safe and a legitimate candidate, they should sit tight.
Well, I personally would believe from a risk perspective it's their choice, but on the other hand, for myself, my family, and others, I wouldn't put my family at that risk if, in fact, there wasn't some occupational exposure or potential there. I would also hopefully count, though, on my local or state public health agency, together with my health care providers in my state, being really prepared to very quickly roll that vaccine out. That's also why we want to have these health care workers vaccinated in advance. Do I want to be vaccinating all the health care workers and, you know, this day that they might not feel so well, right in the middle of a crisis when I need them to be at their very best to be vaccinated the rest of the population should a release actually occur?
Right. Let me ask you, we're getting near the end of our time, but Michael Osterholm, just briefly, are there other infectious agents out there, bioterror agents that we need to worry about? Is this the big one? What do you think?
Well, clearly it's the one that I think has a sense of causing the greatest catastrophic effect, meaning that a couple of cases could shut down the airplanes of the country, et cetera, just because people's fear of it being transmitted person to person, that there could be additional releases. But as we well know, anthrax is a potential. We know that the plague bacteria, Yersinia pestis, which was in the news a week and a half ago when we had a potential theft of the vials in Texas, which turned out not to be the case. There are other agents that have been worked on by a number of different countries and groups that could be, in a sense, weaponized or used against us, all which could result in very high numbers of casualties and could cause great disruption. So part of what, as a nation, we're doing is, in fact, attempting to respond to all of those, having programs in place, some fortune which overlap.
Okay, we're out of time. We'll have to take a break. Thanks very much to both of you. Michael Osterholm, Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Christine Gebbe, Vice Chair of the Institute of Medicine's Committee on the Smallpox Vaccination Program. Thanks to both of you. When we come back, an amazing fossil find. Stay with us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.